The reports were separated into two halves by paperwork documenting the end of the first tour, the routine award of the medal, the long furlough back in New York, the start of the second tour. Then more combat reports, same exact work, same exact pattern. There were fewer reports from the second tour. The very last sheet in the file recorded Lieutenant Victor Hobie's 991st career combat mission. Not routine 1st Cavalry business. It was a special assignment. He took off from Pleiku, heading east for an improvised landing zone near the Amkay Pass. His orders were to fly in as one of two slicks and exfiltrate the personnel waiting on the landing zone. DeWitt was flying backup. Hobie got there first. He landed in the center of the tiny landing zone under heavy machine gun fire from the jungle. He was seen to take on board just three men. He took off again almost immediately. His Huey was taking hits to the airframe from the machine guns. His own gunners were returning fire blind through the jungle canopy. DeWitt was circling as Hobie was heading out. He saw Hobie's Huey take a sustained burst of heavy machine gun fire through the engines. His formal report, as recorded by the dispatch clerk, said he saw the Huey's rotor stop and flames appear in the fuel tank area. The helicopter crashed through the jungle canopy 4 miles west of the landing zone at a low angle and at a speed estimated by DeWitt to be in excess of 80 miles an hour. DeWitt reported a green flash visible through the foliage, which was normally indicative of a fuel tank explosion on the forest floor. A search and rescue operation was mounted and aborted because of weather. No fragments of wreckage were observed. Because the area 4 miles west of the pass was considered inaccessible virgin jungle, it was procedure to assume there were no NVA troops on foot in the immediate vicinity. Therefore, there'd been no risk of immediate capture by the enemy. Therefore, the 8 men in the Huey were listed as missing in action.
"But why?" Jody asked. "DeWitt saw the thing blow up. Why list them as missing? They were obviously all killed, right?"
Major Conrad shrugged. "I guess so," he said. "But nobody knew it for sure. DeWitt saw a flash through the leaves is all. Could theoretically have been an NVA ammo dump hit by a lucky shot from the machine as it went down. Could have been anything. They only ever said killed in action when they knew for damn sure, when somebody literally eyeballed it happening. Fighter planes went down alone 200 miles out in the ocean. The pilot was listed as missing, not killed, because perhaps he could have swum away somewhere. To list them as killed, someone had to see it happen. I could show you a file 10 times thicker than this one, packed with orders defining and redefining exactly how to describe casualties."
"Why?" Jody asked again.
"Because they were afraid of the press?" Conrad shook his head. "No. I'm talking about internal stuff here. Anytime they were afraid of the press, they just told lies. This all was for two reasons. First, they didn't want to get it wrong for the next of kin. Believe me, weird things happened. It was a totally alien environment. People survived things you wouldn't expect them to survive. People turned up later. They found people. There was a massive search and recover deal running all the time. People got taken prisoner, and Charlie never issued prisoner lists, not until years later. And you couldn't tell folks their boy was killed, only to have him turn up alive later on. So they were anxious to keep on saying missing, just as long as they could." Then he paused for a long moment. "Second reason is, yes, they were afraid. But not of the press. They were afraid of themselves. They were afraid of telling themselves they were getting beat, and beat bad." Reacher was scanning the final mission report, picking out the co-pilot's name. He was a second lieutenant named F.G. Kaplan. He had been Hobie's regular partner throughout most of the second tour.
"Can I see this guy's jacket?" he asked.
"K-section?" Conrad said. "Be about 4 minutes."
They sat in silence with the cold coffee until the runner brought F.G. Kaplan's life story to the office.
It was a thick old file, similar size and vintage as Hobie's. There was the same printed grid on the front cover, recording access requests. The only note less than 20 years old showed a telephone inquiry had been made last April by Leon Garber. Reacher turned the file face down and opened it up from the back. Started with the second-to-last sheet of paper. It was identical to the last sheet in Hobie's jacket. The same mission report, with the same eyewitness account from DeWitt, written up by the same clerk, in the same handwriting. But the final sheet in Kaplan's file was dated exactly 2 years later than the final mission report. It was a formal determination made after due consideration of the circumstances by the Department of the Army that F.G. Kaplan had been killed in action 4 miles west of the Ankay Pass when the helicopter he was co-piloting was brought down by enemy ground-to-air fire. No body had been recovered, but the death was to be considered as actual for purposes of memorializing and payment of pensions. Reacher squared the sheet of paper on the desk. "So why doesn't Victor Hobie have one of these?" Conrad shook his head. "I don't know." "I want to go to Texas," Reacher said. Noi Bai Airport outside Hanoi and Hickam Field outside Honolulu share exactly the same latitude, so the U.S. Air Force Starlifter flew neither north nor south. It just followed a pure west-east flight path across the Pacific, holding comfortably between the Tropic of Cancer and the 20th parallel. 6,000 miles, 600 miles an hour, 10 hours flight time. But it was on approach 7 hours before it took off, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon of the day before. The Air Force captain made the usual announcement as they crossed the dateline, and the tall, silver-haired American in the rear of the cockpit wound his watch back and added another bonus day to his life. Hickam Field is Hawaii's main military air facility, but it shares runway space and air traffic control with Honolulu International, so the Starlifter had to turn a wide, weary circle above the sea, waiting for a JAL 747 from Tokyo to get down. Then it turned in and flattened and came down behind it, tires shrieking, engines screaming with reverse thrust. The pilot was not concerned with the niceties of civilian flying, so she jammed the brakes on hard and stopped short enough to get off the runway on the first taxiway. There was a standing request from the airport to keep the military planes away from the tourists, especially the Japanese tourists. This pilot was from Connecticut and had no real interest in Hawaii's staple industry or Oriental sensitivities, but the first taxiway gave her a shorter run to the military compound, which is why she always aimed to take it. The Starlifter taxied slowly, as was appropriate, and stopped 50 yards from a long, low cement building near the wire. The pilot shut down her engines and sat in silence. Ground crew in full uniform marched slowly towards the belly of the plane, dragging a fat cable behind them. They latched it into a port under the nose, and the plane's systems kicked in again under the airfield's own power. That way, the ceremony could be conducted in silence. The honor guard at Hickam that day was the usual 8 men in the usual mosaic of 4 different full-dress uniforms, 2 from the United States Army, 2 from the United States Navy, 2 from the United States Marine Corps, and 2 from the United States Air Force. The 8 slow-marched forward and waited in silent formation. The pilot hit the switch and the rear ramp came whining down. It settled against the hot blacktop of American territory, and the guard slow-marched up its exact center into the belly of the plane. They passed between the twin lines of silent aircrew and moved forward. The loadmaster removed the rubber straps, and the guard lifted the first casket off the shelves and onto their shoulders. They slow-marched back with it, through the darkened fuselage and down the ramp, and out into the blazing afternoon, the shined aluminum winking and the flag glowing bright in the sun against the blue Pacific and the green highlands of Oahu. They right-wheeled on the apron and slow-marched the 50 yards to the long, low cement building. They went inside and bent their knees and laid the casket down.
They stood in silence, hands folded behind them, heads bowed, and then they about turned and slow marched back towards the plane. It took an hour to unload all seven of the caskets. Only when the task was complete did the tall, silver-haired American leave his seat. He used the pilot stairway and paused at the top to stretch his weary limbs in the sun. Stone had to wait 5 minutes behind the black glass in the rear of the Tahoe because the loading dock under the World Trade Center was busy. Tony loitered nearby, leaning on a pillar in the noisy dark, waiting until a delivery truck moved out in a blast of diesel, and there was a moment before the next one could move in. He used that moment to hustle Stone across the garage to the freight elevator. He hit the button and they rode up in silence, heads down, breathing hard, smelling the strong smell of the tough rubber floor. They came out in the back of the 88th floor lobby, and Tony scanned ahead. The way was clear to the door of Hobie's suite. The thick-set man was at the reception counter. They walked straight past him into the office. It was dark, as usual. The blinds were pulled tight, and it was quiet. Hobie was at the desk, sitting still and silent, gazing at Marilyn, who was on the sofa with her legs tucked underneath her.
"Well?" he asked. "Mission accomplished?"
Stone nodded. "She got inside okay."
"Where?" Marilyn asked. "Which hospital?"
"St. Vincent's," Tony said. "Straight into the ER.
Stone nodded to confirm it, and he saw Marilyn smile a slight smile of relief.
"Okay," Hobie said into the silence. "That's the good deed for the day. Now we do business. What are these complications I need to know about?"
Tony shoved Stone around the coffee table to the sofa. He sat down heavily next to Marilyn and stared straight ahead, focusing on nothing.
"Well?"
Hobie said again.
"The stock," Marilyn said. "He doesn't own it outright."
Hobie stared at her.
"Yes, he damn well does. I checked it at the exchange," she nodded. "Well, yes, he owns it. What I mean is, he doesn't control it. He doesn't have free access to it." "Why the hell not? There's a trust. Access is regulated by the trustees." "What trust? Why?"
"His father set it up before he died. He didn't trust Chester to handle it all outright. He felt he needed supervision." Hobie stared at her.
"Any major stock disposals need to be co-signed," she said, "by the trustees."
There was silence.
"Both of them," she said.
Hobie switched his gaze to Chester Stone. It was like a searchlight beam flicking sideways. Marilyn watched his good eye, watched him thinking, watched him buying into the lie like she knew he would, because it jibed with what he thought he already knew. Chester's business was failing because he was a bad businessman. A bad businessman would have been spotted early by a close relative like a father, and a responsible father would have protected the family heritage with a trust.
"It's unbreakable," she said. "God knows we've tried often enough."
Hobie nodded, just a slight movement of his head, almost imperceptible. Marilyn smiled inside, smiled with triumph. Her final comment had done it to him. A trust was a thing to be broken. It had to be fought. Therefore, the attempts to fight it proved it existed.
"Who are the trustees?"
he asked quietly.
"I'm one of them," she said. "The other is the senior partner at his law firm." "Just two trustees?"
she nodded.
"And you're one of them,"
she nodded again. "And you've already got my vote. I just want to get rid of the whole damn thing and get you off our backs." Hobie nodded back to her.
"You're a smart woman."
"Which law firm?" Tony asked.
"Forster and Abelstein," she said, "right here in town."
"Who's the senior partner?"
Tony asked.
"A guy called David Forster," Marilyn said. "How do we set up the meeting?" Hobie asked.
"I call him," Marilyn said, "or Chester does, but I think right now it'd be better if I did."
"So call him. Set it up for this afternoon."
She shook her head.
"It won't be that quick. Could be a couple of days."
There was silence. Just the boom and shudder of the giant building breathing. Hobie tapped his hook on the desk. He closed his eyes. The damaged eyelid stayed open a fraction. The eyeball rolled up and showed white, like a crescent moon.
"Tomorrow morning," he said quietly, "at the very latest. Tell him it's a matter of considerable urgency to you."
Then his eyes snapped open. "And tell him to fax the trust deeds to me," he whispered,
"immediately. I need to know what the hell I'm dealing with."
Marilyn was shaking inside. She pushed down on the soft upholstery, tried to ground herself.
"There won't be a problem. It's really just a formality.